Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, incorporating Mazda's customer-centric vehicle design by making the customer the center of business to create a better car buying experience. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. On the local news roundup, Congress includes a much-needed relief funding package for Western North Carolina and puts it in a stopgap budget bill that Elon Musk and Donald Trump encouraged a no vote on. It got much more complicated than that. It's too complicated for me to explain, but I have people here who can, and we'll get to that in a moment. Governor Roy Cooper makes his farewell address as he prepares to leave office, calling his time in office an unparalleled honor. The city chooses an interim attorney, Anthony Fox, 1X, not the former mayor. A major development on Providence Road is approved with $19 million in tax breaks, a push to get the 1 cent sales tax hike on the November 2025 ballot. A school bus gets caught in crossfire, and we have details on Charlotte's new New Year's Eve celebration. Here to talk about those stories and more is WFAE senior editor Eli Portillo. Mary Ramsey is local government accountability reporter for the Charlotte Observer, and to keep things nice, she sits in between Joe Bruno and Ben Thompson. Joe is a reporter for WSOC-TV and host of their Political Beat program. Ben Thompson is an anchor at WCNC-TV and host of Flashpoint. Morning, everybody. Welcome.
Morning.
Morning.
So, Ben, lucky you, I'm turning to you first on this. I was set to talk about this stopgap spending bill and how they put $100 billion in federal aid to Western North Carolina in it. And it's being insisted on by Senators Tom Tillis and Ted Budd from North Carolina. Elon Musk says no bills should be passed by Congress until January 20th when Trump takes office. Marjorie Taylor Greene and Tim Burchett from Tennessee say shut it down, meaning close the government down. It looks like we may be going in that direction. Something happened late yesterday afternoon that puts all of this in a different light. Can you take us through what happened yesterday?
Okay, so behind all the numbers, you have thousands of people in Western North Carolina who are still waiting on aid. Keep in mind, the first time around, Congress adjourned right before the storm hit because they wanted to go back to their districts because of the election. And Congress knew this. So this has sort of been delayed now for a long time. So when you see Senators Tillis and Budd frustrated, I don't think that's an act. I think they are legitimately frustrated at this point. They say they won't let Congress go home for Christmas until something happens. To give you sort of the schoolhouse rock version of all of this, the Constitution says all budgets must come out of the U.S. House. So up until Wednesday of this week, the House Speaker, Republican, had a compromise with Democrats and Republicans, everybody on board. And then Mr. Trump and Mr. Musk imploded the deal on Wednesday and said they want now the debt ceiling it. Well, the debt ceiling wasn't set to expire till next summer, so it was kind of early to be dealing with it, although not a bad thing. And now they voted on it yesterday afternoon, what you're talking about. Lots of Republicans, the budget halts came out against it. Freedom Caucus came out against it. And so you, again, leave the people of Western North Carolina hanging in the balance, hanging in limbo as they wait for funding that they critically need and they've been needing for months now.
So what is interesting about this is that these people went against, these Republicans went against Donald Trump here. And this is a continuing resolution. We have not had a budget in this country for 20 years or more. They keep funding it with these continuing resolutions, which expire every couple of months. And then we face the possibility of a government shutdown. And now we're facing one again. They're going to vote. They're going to get cobbled together a deal somehow today. What happens if they don't? They adjourn,
then we have
right?
Then we have a government shutdown, and that way, I mean, the government can still work, but you're also talking about, you know, thousands of workers involved in that, a lot here in North Carolina. So there are very real world consequences when you talk about these lawmakers not being able to find a compromise at literally the last minute. They've been able to deal with this now for weeks and months, and it's gotten to this point. And you have now the world's richest man involved in it and telling lawmakers that they need to stand their ground. And you've got a lot of people left in between.
You got two unelected officials here, Elon Musk and Vivek Ramaswamy. They've attacked this bill as excessive in spending. There's not a lot of places you can cut in our budget because the entitlement programs and the defense budget make up the vast majority of it. Musk raised the specter of primary challenges against anybody who voted for this bill, which was defeated, and Trump weighed in himself. Talk about how unusual it is to have two unelected people holding such sway, not only over government policy, but the United States Congress.
Especially when, yes, that's rare and that's strange and not normal, but especially when the incoming administration hasn't even taken office yet. I mean, we're still dealing with a Biden administration, you know, like it or not, that's who's still in office. And so to have two unelected people literally walking up and down the hills of Capitol Hill, calling the shots for better or worse, that in and of itself is kind of unprecedented.
Yeah. Eli, did you want to chime in on that?
Yeah, I was going to say the same thing. You know, we've also got, I think, somewhat of a similar situation to what happened in North Carolina with hurricane relief being tied up in all this. And, you know, you had the Democrats in North Carolina saying, hey, we want a clean hurricane relief bill. We just want, you know, the state to fund that and get the political stuff out of Senate Bill 382, which we've talked about a lot on this show. You kind of have the opposite dynamic in Washington right now in some ways, where you have Republican senators from the Carolinas saying, hey, we want a clean hurricane relief package. We want, you know, $100 billion in funding for Western North Carolina. Untangle it from all this other stuff like the debt ceiling. So similar dynamics on opposite sides in some ways.
And as I think you mentioned, Ben, Senator Tom Tillis has said he wants people to stay until Christmas Day and vote on Christmas Day if they have to get this $100 billion in relief aid passed. But the House does the budget. They have the purse strings. What role does the Senate play in all this besides approving the bill that's passed by the House?
They have to prove it, but it all starts in the House. All budget items start, according to the Constitution, in the House. And so you have to get all 435 members there on board before it even gets to the Senate. And yesterday, Tillis was joined by Senator Budd and Senator Graham from South Carolina, all saying the same thing, basically. Like, we're not going anywhere until this gets passed. Keep in mind, it didn't have to be this way.
What does that mean? We have three senators saying we're not going anywhere until this is passed. Well, the House passes or not passes, and they'll do what they want.
Yeah.
They can do what they want, but we still wouldn't have a budget.
And, you know,
right.
If they get a Republican passed deal out of the House, don't forget the new Senate has not been sworn in yet. Democrats have a majority there right now. So, you know, it's not like a Republican dominated bill can come out of the House and automatically pass the Senate.
Do politicians want to shut down the government and furlough employees at the holidays? Do they want to leave people in hurricane-stricken areas without the relief they need? Is that politically wise?
Do lawmakers or does Elon Musk?
There you go. And therein lies the rub, ladies and gentlemen. Senator Tillis also spent some time this past Sunday blasting those who promised to fund primary challenges against Republican senators who opposed Donald Trump's cabinet picks. He called them political opportunists. Who's making these threats that they're going to primary people who vote against Trump?
Senator Tillis says it's third-party conservative groups. He says he doesn't think it's coming from President-elect Trump. Listen, all presidents, every single one of them, not just Mr. Trump, they all want their cabinet picked. That is nothing new. Right. And they usually back it up by usually saying, hey, I have a mandate of some sort. So none of that is new. But the role of this Senate, of our senators here in North Carolina and all the senators, is advice and consent. It's literally their job. And we want senators, whether you're a Democrat or Republican, you want senators who are going to advocate for us, who serve us. In this case, I know earlier this week, Ted Budd spoke on CNN about the fact that RFK and the other nominees are going to get his vote, are going to get his support. Although, and it was pressed about this, the fact that RFK came out years ago and said that hog farmers are worse than Osama bin Laden. Well, North Carolina is one of the top pork producing, states in the country. And so you got to have senators who are going to advocate for their voters. It just happens to be that you have a situation now, whether with Elon Musk or others, that don't like the pushback they're getting from some Republicans.
The other you're referring to is Turning Point USA's Charlie Kirk, who has also suggested that he would support intra-party challenges to GOP members who don't back Trump's nominees. The goodbye tour is short-lived for Governor Cooper. I think it's a one-stop tour in his home county of Nash County. He called it an unparalleled honor. It's what he called his time in the governor's mansion, as he reflected this week on his accomplishments, including our growing economy and infrastructure investments that he pointed to. And he reminded people that despite a lack of power, he was able to secure more funding for education.
We succeeded in pushing the General Assembly further than they otherwise would have gone on education investments, expanding North Carolina pre-K, reinstating the Teacher Fellows Program, and we've gotten public school teachers a total of 19% in raises over the years. Obviously, not nearly enough, but important to get.
And, of course, he spoke about what is likely to be his greatest accomplishment, Medicaid expansion.
We have covered more than 600,000 people with health insurance through Medicaid expansion. And we have restored our reputation as a welcoming place where people can thrive, innovate, and grow.
So he made the speech in Nash County. That's his home county. Is it too early, Joe, to assess where he falls in the pantheon of the state's governors?
Perhaps. I think that... First of all, Medicaid expansion is a huge accomplishment that he should take a victory lap on, because nobody gave him a shot at getting that done when he was first elected. And that was always his top priority. And somehow, even with a Republican supermajority, he was able to get that done, or a near Republican supermajority at the time when that was enacted. I think that when you look back at his legacy, you will see a governor who got a lot done despite a lot being blown in his direction. He had to work with Republicans on a number of issues. Of course, COVID will be part of that legacy as well. HB2, the first thing, first major issue, he came into office. He was able to negotiate a repeal with Republicans. It's been a lot of negotiating for him over the past 8 years. But I think for a Democratic governor in the South, he has a record that he will be sure to bring up should he run in 2026.
He won his first term by beating Charlotte Republican incumbent Pat McCrory. He was briefly rumored to be a possible vice presidential pick for Kamala Harris in this last campaign. And he says he's not done. There, of course, is speculation that he may choose to run for the Senate seat held right now by Senator Tillis. What has he said about that, Eli?
He has said that he's considering his possibilities and, remains open to it, hasn't made any decisions. I think you have to keep in mind he's going to leave office as a two-term governor, Democratic governor, who is pretty popular in this state, but he has unfinished business. He never delivered the state as a win for a Democratic presidential candidate, and also did not, help get a Senate candidate over the finish line, lost the state Supreme Court for the Democrats with their majority. So I think, he's had a lot of successes, but except for his own victory, there's still a lot of unfinished Democratic business in this state. Yeah. And I think he's going to be back in 26 to try
can
to finish
you lay that,
that off.
Can you lay that at any governor's feet, the loss of the Supreme Court, the lack of a presidential candidate from your party winning? I'll let you think about that because we have to take a break. We'll come back and we'll get an answer to that and more in a moment. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on Listener Funded, 90.7 WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. It's the local news roundup with Eli Portillo, our senior editor here at WFAE News. Joe Bruno's with us, reporter at WSOC-TV and host of the Political Beat program on Sundays. Mary Ramsey, local government accountability reporter for the Charlotte Observer. And Ben Thompson, an anchor at WCNC-TV and host of their Flashpoint program, also on Sunday morning. It's the battle of the anchors here on WFAE this morning. So Governor Cooper making his farewell address this week in Nash County, listing all of his accomplishments. You just listed, Eli, many of his lacks, I want to call them failures, but his unsuccesses, let's call them that. But can those be laid at the foot of any governor?
Well, really? I don't think directly, you know, you can say, oh, he failed to do this. But, you know, he campaigned a lot with Kamala Harris and right. Joe Biden. He, you know, was a key player in trying to help Democrats win the state and also win the previous Senate race. So, you know, I think the Democrats lost those races for flipping North Carolina and for U.S. Senate and some state Supreme Court races that were really close and really winnable, viewed as that by the party. I obviously don't have a window into Roy Cooper's mind, but, you know, you have to think, if you're a political animal who's been in office for decades and your party under your stewardship lost a couple of those big prizes, and one of those big prizes is up for grabs again in 2026, it's hard to imagine, you know, he doesn't reach out and say, hey, yeah, this is my next thing. I'm going to win that Senate seat for us.
Joe.
Yeah, he didn't have any coattails in 2020. That was a weird year, though. People weren't campaigning. I will say, though, the Democratic Party in 2024 had its best year in North Carolina in a long, long time, winning the governor, lieutenant governor, state superintendent. The peers, they've won the Supreme Court seat, as well as a couple other major races. The thing that Cooper has going for him in 2026 is I don't think he's lost a statewide election going back to 2000. I believe that was the first year he won the attorney general's race. He can raise a ton of money. He will clear the field, and a ton of money is going to be needed. Senator Tillis also has a bipartisan record and is raising money as well. And this is going to be a really big showdown in 26.
Mary first, then Ben. Mary.
Yeah, just wanted to add, I think, on this point, you know, if you're Roy Cooper and you're looking to package yourself as a Democratic Senate candidate in 2026, I think a big part of your pitch becomes, I have been able to defy these statewide negative trends for Democrats. I have been able to carry this state. My successor, Josh Stein, was able to carry this state when the national Democrats who rolled into town were not, when we were not able to keep things like the state Supreme Court, when Republicans were able to get a supermajority in the state legislature. So I think from a political standpoint, there is a way to sort of spin those lack of successes by the party as a selling point for Cooper by sort of framing yourself as the great leader. That doesn't necessarily always work. That was something that came up a lot when Barack Obama was president. He was able to have a lot of electoral success, was known as this incredible campaigner, but at the same time, Democrats were losing state legislators. They were losing governorships. So it's a bit of a mixed bag, but I think there is a way to sell it as a selling point.
Ben.
The best thing Roy Cooper has going for him going into 2026 is, visiting our prior conversation, the Republican Party is going to primary Tom Tillis. And it's going to be an expensive primary, probably the most expensive primary in state history and probably in the country that year. And so by the time Tom Tillis gets to the actual general election, say it is Roy Cooper, he will have gone through a war chest of money. As have Republicans. So the best thing that could happen for Roy Cooper is that he runs unopposed in his primary and Tillis has a whopper of a primary.
So Cooper made a point of talking about his successes in that speech against the backdrop of having his power limited, increasingly so, by the Republican-controlled legislature. And they are about to really do it, to Josh Stein, because they've just passed more restrictions on what governors can do. Any governor, not just Democratic governors, but in this case it happens to be a Democrat. Will Josh Stein be able to get things done or to maneuver around restrictions that the legislature has put on the executive branch?
Well, Eli. I think a lot of Stein's role is going to be similar to the role he played as Attorney General, which is trying to hold back the legislature, trying to act in opposition to bills the legislature advances, priorities the legislature has. You know, Cooper, as we said, got Medicaid expansion over the finish line, took years and years and years, really big policy accomplishment. Now, you know, he's also talked about education, but if you look at education, yes, funding went up, but the legislature also passed this massive voucher bill for private schools that Cooper wasn't able to stop. So I think for Stein, a lot of it's going to come down to not how much he can do, but how much he can stop Republicans from doing.
Joe.
I think Republicans have a working supermajority as well. There are three or four Dems who have shown that they are willing to negotiate with Republicans on key issues and override even the governor's vetoes when necessary. So it'll be interesting to see how Governor-elect Stein navigates that. You'll remember at one point, Cooper primaried a Fayetteville legislator who wasn't voting, in Cooper's mind, enough with the party. And he put a lot of capital into that primary race and got someone who would uphold his veto. But I think at the end of the day, it didn't matter because Republicans picked up other seats elsewhere. And then, of course, we just saw this letter released from Cecil Brockman of High Point and Guilford County, basically saying, yo, Democrats, you need me. I don't need you. Lay off a bit.
Well, you brought that up very early. I was going to bring it up much later in the program, and that's okay. I'm going to try to find it here very quickly because it is cogent to the conversation, but I can't find it. So
yeah,
we'll come back to that.
I can give you a little bit of background that you'll look for.
No, we'll come back. Well, go ahead. Give us some background. I'll look for it.
So this was all in the context of the relief bill that has a lot of other stuff in it that they just voted to override the veto of in the legislature. And Cecil Brockman was absent, and he put out this letter. He took a lot of heat for being absent. So he put out this letter responding to his critics saying, I found out that Republicans already had the votes, so I prioritized my health. I was sick. And then he went into how Democrats are tearing into him and how it's not right because he works with Republicans on key issues to benefit his district, and they need him. The Democrats need him. He doesn't need them.
Yeah, he says he's being scapegoated. He compares his treatment very much to how Tricia Cotham says she was treated before she switched from Democratic to the Republican Party. And I was thinking, well, maybe this is the beginning of another defection. He says no. But when he spoke to the Raleigh News and Observer, he had some advice for fellow Democrats.
I was like texting with a few friends of mine. I texted them the video. They were like, oh, Jack got a... I was like texting with a few friends of mine.
I'm a Democrat. I've been a Democrat my whole life, you know?
There we go.
We've got to come together, though. You know, we've got to stop attacking each other. Mm-hmm. You know, I think that's the main thing.
Okay, we got it right in the end. You threw us a curve, Joe. Don't ever do that again. Meanwhile, the mini soldier has returned. M-I-N-I-S-O-L-D-R is how you spell that, because that is the handle that Lieutenant Governor Mark Robinson allegedly used on the porn site Nude Africa to make lewd and offensive posts. CNN reported that. Robinson denied it. He has disavowed any connection between him and that handle, but now he's used it to buy things on Amazon, but now he's used it to get into a state meeting. Talk about this.
Yeah.
Eli, where and how?
So this was a really weird story that is kind of the coda to a really weird story that came up this week. The Assembly reported first that Mark Robinson was, in his capacity as lieutenant governor, convening a virtual meeting about the transition to the new administration. When he logged on to this virtual meeting, you know, we're all familiar with logging on to Zoom, Google Meets, whatever, you have your name. His name was Mini Soldier or Mini Solder. It's kind of unclear how you pronounce it. several participants noted this and reported it to media outlets. The reason it's notable is that the entire CNN article, which was this bombshell that dropped in late September about these lewd comments, their reporting hinged on tying Mark Robinson through personal email addresses and other shared accounts to this unusually spelled username on the Nude Africa site. The crux of their reporting was Mark Robinson uses this username. The crux of his denial was pretty much, no, I don't. That wasn't me. So to see him log on to an official state meeting in his official capacity with this username was kind of surprising, to say the least. And when contacted by his campaign, or when contacting his campaign spokesman, WRAL reported that they said, yeah, of course that's his username. He's used it for decades. It's so well known, in fact, that people know he uses it and were able to use it to impersonate him and make up these lewd comments. So
now, yes, it is feasible, I suppose, for somebody else to use that exact same name, not even know who Mark Robinson is, and be on that website. That is feasible, and that is why Mark Robinson has been denying this. He's suing CNN for making the allegations. CNN has moved to have the case moved to federal court because they are not located in North Carolina. Robinson is now trying to move it back to state court, and CNN has filed motions to have the whole thing dismissed. So where does this all stand, this back and forth between Robinson and CNN?
You know, I would not be surprised if a judge looked at the facts of the case and dismissed it based on my, you know, J-school understanding of defamation law and how that works. I'm not a lawyer. I think, you know, the case is going to drag on. At some point, there's a cost-benefit analysis for Mark Robinson, I think, both in terms of the actual cost of pursuing legal action, but also how long do you keep pursuing this and dragging it up in the public mind? You know, every time there's a hearing on this, every time there's a motion in the case, it's going to be re-reported and re-reported and re-reported. So, you know, I don't know. At some point, does Mark Robinson say, let sleeping dogs lie, I'm going to try my next act and try to just move past this thing?
So the winner in the governor's race, Josh Stein, Governor-elect Josh Stein, is now making appointments to his cabinet. And this week he chose Gabe Esparza, who happens to be from Charlotte. He is the state's first Latino cabinet member. What position is he slated to take? Joe.
He will lead the Department of Administration. I got to know Gabe through his campaign for state treasurer. Very smart guy, very nice guy. He actually was part of the Biden administration. He was part of the U.S. Small Business Administration. So this seems like a good fit for him in this role.
He's also appointed the first Indian American. And by that mean, I mean an American from the country India to be a secretary of Department of Health and Human Services. I think you say his name, Devduta Sangvai, is that correct? And he's keeping five members of the Cooper administration in his cabinet. He's also nominated 11 people in all. They all have to be confirmed by the Republican-controlled Senate. Has there been any reaction from members of that body that we know of?
Not particularly yet, but it's early, and the new batch of lawmakers has to be sworn in, so I think we'll reset after the new year.
So this is becoming the HB2 of 2024, and I'm talking about the never-ending Allison Riggs-Jefferson Griffin race for the seat on the state Supreme Court. It continues. The first counting of the votes revealed Allison Riggs had won by a narrow margin. They went back and they did a hand-to-eye recount from a percentage of each precinct, and each time she won. Democratic incumbent Riggs won by more than 700 votes, in fact. Griffin, a judge on the North Carolina Court of Appeals, wants 60,000 votes thrown out. We've talked about that. Where does that stand, Eli?
That case is winding its way very quickly through the court system. The State Board of Elections has filed to remove it to federal court. It was originally filed in state court in front of the state Supreme Court. Jefferson Griffin basically, you know, instead of filing it at a superior court and then appealing it, he used a legal method to file his move, asking the state Supreme Court to throw the votes out straight to the state Supreme Court, saying this is urgent. It can't go through the appeals process. You got to hear it right now. It doesn't look like the state Supreme Court is going to hear it first. It'll be in federal. because, you know, the State Board of Elections says federal election law is at issue here. I think legal maneuvering aside, the really big picture is this is a pretty unprecedented move to throw out ballots after they were cast rather en masse rather than disqualifying voters or challenging provisional ballots at the, you know, canvas stage. So big picture, it's kind of hard to imagine, you know, if Griffin wins his appeal and, you know, say there is a new election ordered like there was in the 9th District congressional race, say that eventually happens, I think Democrats would be absolutely furious. So it's hard for me to see a scenario where, you know, where he ends up on the Supreme Court. But again, I'm not a lawyer. I don't know.
So the Democratic Board of Elections says that Griffin failed to establish enough evidence of voting irregularities to cancel out 60,000 votes. Joe, I know you wanted to talk about that. You would expect that Democrats would say that, and it's a Democrat-controlled body, but would the court agree with that?
A federal judge has already ruled on one of, like, the crux of Griffin's lawsuit. One of the things that Griffin says is he is challenging a chunk of voters whose information in the file may be missing or wasn't reported, the driver's license number or the social security number. And a federal judge before the election said that's not enough to purge these voters from the rolls. So I think if you're Allison Riggs, you're happy to hear that a judge has already said that. You know, of course, we're judge shopping and court shopping right now, so who knows where we will end up here. What I want to talk about just real quick on what Eli was saying, I'm like shocked that this isn't a bigger story, you know, for in Republican and Democratic circles on the national level, because this is a state Supreme Court race, 60,000 votes at stake that may be tossed out if everything goes to plan. This is a huge deal, and I'm surprised that it isn't receiving more attention outside of North Carolina.
And it's kind of a threat to democracy. It appears this could be legit, but then it could be that I'm not going to concede. I'm not. Well, also, that seems to be a pattern in elections of late. Ben, go ahead.
Also, it's not unheard of, despite what you are made to believe, as far as, and it was just 4 years ago, we had a Supreme Court race that was even closer than this. It came down to 400 votes. So it's not like this is unheard of or this has never happened. Then it was Paul Newby and Sherry Beasley. This time it's these two. So we know we have tight races.
Some confusion over HB 10 at the Mecklenburg County Sheriff's Office. We're going to talk about that next, because that deals with dealing with ICE at the sheriff's level. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks and the local news roundup on WFAE and WFAE.org. Eli Portillo joins us. He's WFAE senior editor. Joe Bruno, reporter and host at WSOC-TV. Ben Thompson, anchor and host at WCNC-TV. And Mary Ramsey, local government accountability reporter for the Charlotte Observer. The legislature passed HB 10, which mandates the state's sheriff's offices cooperate with ICE in their efforts to identify undocumented immigrants. It requires sheriffs to hold undocumented immigrants for up to 48 hours, and it's written into the law that way, in part because some Democratic sheriffs refused to cooperate with ICE in the past. But there seems to be some confusion about exactly what this law requires. Joe, how so?
There's a lot of things going on with this law and how it's being implemented in Mecklenburg County. First of all, 32 detainers have been issued by ICE to Mecklenburg County's jail as of 2 days ago or whenever I did this story. And I got the list of names of all the people who had detainers placed on them. I put them all through Portal and discovered that 13 have since been released. So they had the detainers on them. ICE never came and picked them up. They met all the other standards and they left. ICE is saying that the sheriff is not calling to let them know that, hey, these guys are going to leave. The sheriff is saying he doesn't have to. That's not in the law. He just has to hold them. So that's one of the conflicts.
He told you that he let these inmates, well, these detainees go after 48 hours because the law doesn't say he has to keep them beyond that. So you asked him a perfectly reasonable question.
Why not give them a call to let them know, like, hey, this detainer just expired. He's free to go now.
That's something we have to talk about. I'm not sure why we do that. I'm not sure.
He's the sheriff. What do you mean he doesn't know why?
But this is, they are going to have to get, the Trump is coming. They're going to have to get a policy in place right now. And we've talked about this, the sheriff and I, and he's been told by ICE that they're kind of in a holding pattern right now because a lot of the people who are working for ICE might not be working for ICE in a couple of weeks. But the sheriff fully expects there to be a lot more deportation when Trump takes office in January. And this little holding pattern that they're in right now won't last.
And there's another wrinkle to this, because he told you, and you checked this out, he detained 32 people since this law went into effect. But ICE did not pick up a single one of them, even after they were notified and held for 48 hours. And he says he doesn't know what would happen if they tried to pick them up.
The order, HB 10, only says that we hold you for the 48 hours. It doesn't say that we turn you over to ICE. We are holding you for 48 hours. And so I think those are discussions that we need to have.
He's one of the sheriffs that didn't want to cooperate with ICE in the past. Is he being a stickler on this because he's simply going to follow the law exactly as it is written? Or is he being a stickler because he's not on board with the spirit of the law?
I think that there are some questions that he's raising that are valid points that probably should have been addressed in the law more clear. One example is the 48-hour hold. Does it start when the warrant is signed, or are holidays and weekends excluded? Right now, he is excluding holidays and weekends. And one point that he is making is that could mean people are held for longer than 48 hours. And we are seeing, of the 13, I know some of them who were held for 48 hours under normal circumstances would have been able to leave right away because of the nature of their charges, the nature of their bond. It was unsecured, or it was just a misdemeanor DUI, something along those lines. So there are people that are staying in the jail longer at a cost to Mecklenburg County taxpayers, $181 a day. Because at this point, ICE is not picking them up. But again, this isn't going to last forever. Eventually, right. ICE will start picking people up.
January 20th, looming large. A couple of weeks ago, a Charlotte City Council announced it would end the employment of City Attorney Patrick Baker at the end of this year. They never said exactly why, but there is strong reason to believe they let him go for, among other things, providing WFAE with public records that we requested under the Freedom of Information Act. This week, the city appointed an interim city attorney, Anthony Fox, not the former mayor. He has two X's in his name. This one has only one. This Fox is with the law firm Parker Poe. They'll spend the next 6 months looking for a permanent replacement. So, Mary, Patrick Baker was an at-will employee, meaning that he could be fired at any time without cause. The Observer looked into this and found that if he was fired without cause, he would get a lump sum severance payment worth 6 months of his salary, but he gets no severance if terminated for good cause. What was the case here? Did we know?
We still don't know because the city has not publicly said. The city never announced that Patrick Baker was fired. Your excellent colleague, Steve Harrison, obtained a memo in which he told city leaders that his last day was December 31st. But that's the only record we have of Patrick Baker leaving up until this vote in the middle of a zoning meeting, a vote that was not on the agenda. So we still don't know the circumstances officially. Obviously, Steve's excellent reporting sheds a lot of light on what happened behind the scenes, but we still don't know what the official designation was or whether he's getting any money on the way out the door.
Joe.
One thing I'll just say, just to shine a little bit of behind the scenes into my reporting on this, is I tried to follow Steve's great reporting. And from what I understand, the city brought in a third party attorney who put the fear of God in Charlotte City Council members to stop talking about this. So I haven't been able to learn much new information exactly on why Patrick Baker is no longer going to be the city attorney in 11 days. But, hopefully the onion will start to peel back. The layers of the onion will peel back once 31st expires, and maybe the city will release some of these records.
good luck with that. Believe it or not, the city council elections are looming large, and among offices up for grabs would be Charlotte Mayor Vi Lyles. She's been in that position since 2017. What has she said, Joe, about running for re-election?
So I asked her twice earlier this week. The interview is going to air next week, but she hasn't made a decision, short way. She's undecided if she will run for re-election in 2025. She told me to go down to the Board of Elections in July and see if she shows up, essentially. I think her main priority right now is to get that sales tax increase referendum on the ballot. I think, personally, she cares more about that happening than her own name being on it. But if she doesn't run in 2025, it's going to be a fun year because a whole lot of people are going to take a look at running for that seat. And then that will open up other seats and we could have a completely new city council.
So there is this full court press right now to get this sales tax referendum on the November 2025 ballot. That's going to be, as you said, one of her key agenda items for the year. And Malcolm Graham, member of city council, also provided the sense of urgency about this. He says the General Assembly would have to say yes to this measure by March, or a vote is not likely to happen. Why? Ben?
They got to get it on the ballot. Yeah, sorry. They got to get it on the ballot. And they got to organize a campaign and convince voters to support it. So that March timeline is great in many ways. The city's already behind on this. I think that there's some disappointment as well that, and well, maybe not disappointment, but fear and uncertainty over federal funding for some of these projects. I think that there were a lot of hope that they could tap into the infrastructure law and maybe that the Biden administration would have been better or easier to convince to fund some of these projects. And now there's a lot of uncertainty about landing some of the funding with a new administration coming in.
So this is for our transit plan. We need the money, for the permission to raise that money through a 1 cent sales tax for transit, and we need to have the legislature's permission to put it on the ballot in November. In reporting on this, WCNC describes the city as, quote, racing against the clock. Ben, we've been talking about this for decades now. Why are we suddenly in a race to the finish line?
Mike, it shocks me every time I talk to some of the parties involved with this, and we're going back years, every time, how little coordination there is between the city and the state. And when by little, I mean next to nothing, at least that anybody's talking about. And I think Malcolm Graham will say they're putting all their eggs in one basket for this. Raleigh, come March, they're going to want specifics, and I'm not sure we have yet the specifics they're going to want before they sign off on this.
We have been talking about this literally for decades.
And this particular iteration of this plan is turning five in the coming year. So, you know, we're talking 5 years that the transit sales tax has been on the board here. So the fact that, you know, like you say, we don't have the specifics to get to the legislature, right, and we're not sure if they're even going to approve it in time. It's kind of shocking because if they don't, then we're looking at what, a 6-year-old plan? At some point, you got to go back to the drawing board and re-examine your assumptions.
Mary and Joe both want to get on this. Mary?
Yes. So I think it's also worth noting that when Malcolm Graham made these comments, as Ben just alluded to a little bit, he was asked point blank by the reporters in the room, what's plan B? What is the city's backup plan if this doesn't work out? And he said, I'm not sure we have one. We're putting all our eggs in one basket. So to Eli's point, you know, in theory, there could be a situation where they have to go back to the drawing board. But as of right now, it doesn't seem like there's much on it.
Joe?
Mike, you already know what's going to happen. We're going to get the specifics on a cold winter night in room 267 in a dinner briefing, and then there'll be a major vote on it a week later. So that is what we are looking at. That's how the city has been operating, and we'll see if they can convince the General Assembly in early 2025 to allow them to have this.
I want to remind folks that we just paid a lot of money for the Red Line, and there's no plan B. So if this funding doesn't come through, we have a bunch of tracks. I'm not sure what we'll do with them. For months, we've been hearing about a major development near the intersection of Old Providence Road, Providence Road, and Sardis Lane. And this week, it came one step closer to reality when Charlotte City Council approved three rezoning requests. What will that allow developers to do, Mary?
Yeah, the site's going to be home to a few different things. There's going to be some affordable housing, some workforce housing, and market rate housing. There's also plans for some other amenities, including a grocery store. So really going to be a variety of things on this rather large property.
So there was a great concern initially about traffic congestion, the congestion that this project would cause to happen. And as you mentioned, this is an 115-acre project with mixed-used homes and mixed-income homes and a grocery store and a daycare center, retail office space. Is traffic no longer a concern?
It's not something that came up a lot sort of late in the game with these discussions, both the to my knowledge, both the discussions of the zoning decisions as well as a previous city council decision this month to give some tax breaks to the development. And the county will consider giving similar tax breaks in the new year.
Right.
So it's definitely something that I was hearing a little bit more in the earlier stages of things. I think oftentimes with these zoning decisions, the planning commission and planning staff tend to sort of iron out the details in the background. So by the time things actually get in front of the city council, the deal is pretty much already done. Councilman Tarek Bakari, whose district includes this site, was a big advocate for the project from the dais, said he thought the developers and staff worked out a really good deal here. So not a lot of drama around this vote in the end.
And Tarek was one of those people who were concerned about the traffic, and he says that this plan now addresses several problems, including increased concerns about increased traffic.
This Providence Road corridor is a problem. It has been a problem for a long time, and we have just been in a spot of inability to address it.
He says this is a unique opportunity to revitalize an area developed over 60 years ago and that it will, quote, replace deteriorated older buildings and enhance open space and improved connectivity. But, Eli, how does it address traffic concerns?
Well, the developers have agreed to pay for improvements at 22 intersections, so up and down Providence Road and in the area. So there will be some infrastructure improvements to go along with the development. Also, you know, putting this development there replaces a lot of older apartments, like he was saying, and it'll include things that aren't there now, like a grocery store. So, for example, right now, if you want to drive to the store, you got to go all the way down Providence. Now they say you'll be able to just go right in your neighborhood. So less traffic.
Christmas is next week. That means New Year's Eve is the week after that. Joe, Mary, I'm not sure which one of you wants to talk about this, but we used to have something called First Night. It was Charlotte's New Year's Eve celebration. It was up and down Tryon Street. Then they moved it last year to the Avenue of the Arts, but there was a shooting at Romare Bearden Park, which is right down the street, and that put the damper on everything. And now they've moved it yet again. Where will it be this time?
This year, it's going to be at Truist Field at part of the Charlotte Lights Light the Nights Festival.
And that's a block away from Romare Bearden Park. Do people feel safe about that?
Well, the idea, first of all, I should note that officials with Center City Partners, which has been a long time planner of this event, say that the decision to move to Truist Field has been in the works for a while, that it is unrelated to last year's shooting. That being said, obviously, last year's shooting is still very high on everybody's mind. And Malcolm Graham, at that same media briefing that we discussed previously this week, noted that by moving things to Truist Field, it's going to be a little more contained. It'll be a ticketed event rather than people coming and going. People will go through security measures just like they would if they were going to a night's game to get into the event. So there is the idea that things might be a little more easier to control from a safety point by putting things in a contained site rather than just everybody milling about on the street.
Meanwhile, on Monday, the 20-year-old man who shot five people last New Year's Eve pleaded guilty to assault with a deadly weapon inflicting serious injury. That's the charge. Joe, what was his sentence?
He will end up serving between 20 to 36 months in prison with credit for just about 12 months served. I was in court with him. He did not say anything, did not apologize to the families. His attorney said that he brought the gun because somebody had broken into his friend's car the past school year. And the attorney claims that he's remorseful for doing what he did.
Couple of significant passings to note. First, Max Mullman, who is responsible in large part for shepherding the arrival of both the Hornets and the Panthers, and who had his fingers in a lot of sports pies in this town, and including the invention of PSLs, which financed the building of Bank of America Stadium. He passed away on Saturday at the age of 88. And John Spratt, the longtime Democratic congressman who's South Carolina, who accomplished many things, including a budget deal, a balanced budget deal in the 90s, who was then unseated later, ironically, by the Tea Party, who was looking for balanced budgets. He died this week at 82 and got the praise of Democrats and Republicans alike. Eli Portillo from WFAE, Joe Bruno from WSOC, Mary Ramsey from the Charlotte Observer, Ben Thompson from WCNC. Thank you all for the hour.
Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Gabe Altieri. The senior producer is Sarah D'Elia. We have production help from Gene Davis, Chris Jones, and Jesse Steinmetz. For information on Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or subscribe to the Charlotte Talks podcast, visit WFAE.org/Charlotte Talks. Additional support for WFAE programming comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at mazdaofsouthcharlotte.com.